Hi, this is Tim.
And I'm Wendy.
And welcome to the Foster Parenting Podcast.
We created this show to educate our friends, family,
and anyone who wants to listen
about our lives as foster parents.
Andrea's got new glasses.
She does. She's the first person in our family, the family of the four of us, to wear glasses.
Yes, but not the first time we've had to get glasses for a kid.
Right. Our foster sons both had glasses last year, but...
And what I was saying to Wendy about Andrea getting glasses is that every time I've had to get glasses for a kid, I'm glad. Because it is a solvable problem.
Yes.
Things immediately get better for that kid.
There's a number of things going on with the brains of our children that we can't understand and can't figure out, a lot of discipline issues. But you know what? When a kid gets glasses, it's a pretty simple solution.
Yep.
As long as that was the actual problem.
And Andrea just turned 9, and I let her choose her own glasses when I took her in, and she did great.
And something that a lot of friends ask when I tell them that she's getting glasses is, you know, is she nervous about it? Is she worried about what her friends would think? And she just had this great attitude about it. You know, she has friends at school with glasses who get made fun of. And when she, you know, got diagnosed and ordered her frames and everything, I asked her how she felt about it. And she said, "I feel great. Some kids at school, they'll make fun of me. I know they'll make fun of me because I'm wearing glasses, but I don't care. I think they look good and I'm different and that's fine."
You can't see the look on Wendy's face. Wendy forgot this is an audio podcast.
What was the look on my face?
The look on your face was like, what kid is this that said that?
Yeah, she's just got this great self-confidence going into it, and I'm really proud of her, and she has been that way. She's kept her glasses on. She kind of tweaked them the other night by accident, and I had told her. She kept taking them off while she was watching TV and playing with them, and I think I had just told her, if you touch them too much, they'll break. And what I meant is, if you play around with them, that's how they're going to break. But the words I said was, if you touch them too much, they'll break. And that very night, they did kind of get tweaked, and Tim had to fix them. That's you.
Oh.
Yeah. And so then that next morning she woke up and said, "Mom, I dreamt about my glasses. I dreamt they broke." And I said, "Wow, why do you think that was?" And she said, "Well, cause I kind of broke them last night. And cause you said, if I touch them, they'll break." So we had to talk about how it's not actually just being touched that causes your glasses to break.
Well done.
Was that a boring story? You look a little bored.
It's just that I've heard it 5 times.
5?
No, not at all.
Oh, my goodness. If I'm ever there, you have to let me know.
But how many times would I have to let you know?
Oh, good point. Okay.
The other thing that happened was we had a birth parent visit.
Yep, which means we visited with our daughter's birth parent.
And their birth grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And that went well. Afterwards, Linda had a brief... she was challenging the setup a little bit, and she goes, that was my real mom, right? Mm-hmm. And we corrected her that was her bio mom, and that Wendy is her real mom, because Wendy's the one who acts like her mom right now.
Mm-hmm. Who's fulfilling that role.
Yep, that's what we said.
Yes.
And everything was fine after that. Mm-hmm. And, we don't get those questions ever, but she was definitely, you know, exploring the issues. Which is part of the reason why we do the birth parent visits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, like the whole real mom thing. I think we told a story recently about Andrea identifying me as her real family, and like the word real, it feels kind of loaded to us as adoptive parents because, you know, we're petrified that our child will not think of us as their real parents, but really it's nomenclature. It's just a word. And even if all their friends at school say real mom and think about a birth parent, even if, you know, adults in our lives mistakenly use that language, it doesn't change the way our kids feel and think. And so I don't feel threatened by it.
Nor should you.
Do you?
No.
Nor should you.
Thank you. Well, tonight's episode is might be a little controversial in some sectors.
Yes, and that's because we were at the Orphan Summit last week.
And there's nothing controversial about the Orphan Summit, but there was an acquaintance of ours named Johnson Moore, and he is quite passionate about ICWA. What's ICWA?
ICWA is the Indian Child Welfare Act. It's legislation that governs what happens to kids.
Oh, wait. Let's just let Johnson explain.
You asked me what it was.
Well, we have a great interview. He actually did a really good job of explaining all of the issues related to ICWA, and I learned quite a bit while interviewing him, and that will probably become clear as you listen. All right, well, I'm here with Johnson Moore, and Johnson, why don't you just go ahead and tell us how you and your family are involved in foster care?
Okay, my wife, Terry, and I have been fostering and adopting for about a dozen years now. We took our first two kids in July of 2000. We've adopted six so far, and we're also fostering a seventh right now. Our kids range in age from 2 to 20. At a certain point, this became less about how we're going to build our family and more about a ministry, and so now we actually advocate and speak up for kids all over the country, encourage others to get involved, speak at churches, at conferences, and things like that. So it's really become a passion for us.
That's great. I brought you here because you're passionate about something else, specifically with foster care, and that is ICWA. For people who don't know, ICWA stands for the Indian Child Welfare Act. Is that right? And why don't you just go ahead and tell us the history of ICWA, why it got started, why it's good, and why this program is in place at all?
Okay, back in the 1960s and 70s, a lot of social workers, well-meaning social workers, were going into Indian reservations and taking children off the reservation and placing them into non-native foster homes. And a lot of times they were using more Western standards to judge whether or not the family was taking proper care of the kids. And many times the tribes would come in and saying, wait, you're taking away our children, you're ripping them from their culture, and you're applying your parenting practices and parenting standards to us, and we actually raise children differently. And so there were hearings back leading up to the act being passed in 1978. The hearings started back in the mid-70s, and a lot of people testified, a lot of tribes testified, and so Congress passed this act called the Indian Child Welfare Act, which involves the tribes in child welfare decisions for kids that are Native American. And so certain protections were put in place to prevent to prevent the breakup of Indian families and to help kids maintain ties to their culture. And so that was the purpose behind the act when it was passed in 1978.
And we should just point out that the United States has a really poor history of treating Native Americans really terribly, really poorly. Over time, the tribes were given more autonomy, viewed as independent nations within the United States. And so ICWA was part of a way to just affirm their autonomy and make sure that they have control over the care of their own people. So your passion for ICWA is not that it exists, but that it's in many ways being abused. And why don't you just tell us, however you want, how that's abused, maybe some short stories about how the tribes or social workers are misusing this protection.
Sure. What happened, the way we got involved in the Indian Child Welfare Act and became aware of it was because our first two sons came to us in July of 2000, and everything looked like it was going to be a fast-track adoption. The kids were calling us mom and dad after 2 or 3 weeks. Their social worker at the time was saying she's never seen foster kids and foster parents bond as quickly as we had. They did an adoption assessment on our home within the first 2 months, and they said, you know, everybody was thrilled with the way this case was going. And we appeared to be definitely the best possible home for these two boys. And then it was discovered about 5 months into their placement that they're part Native American, and we didn't really understand what that meant at first. The case was taken away from the social worker who had the case, and it was given to a unit that dealt just with Indian cases. And suddenly we were told that we weren't the best home for these kids. In fact, we weren't a suitable home at all because the kids are Native and we're not. As it turns out, the boys are 1/16th Native American. They're part of a tribe in northeast Kansas called the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, and that was enough to qualify them for membership in their tribe. And so,
real quick, 1/16th, that means their grandfather or grandmother is Native American?
It means one of their great-great-grandparents. One of their 16 great-great-grandparents was Native American.
Okay.
And the other 15 were not. And so that's what confused us, is that these kids who had come into the system One had been labeled Caucasian and one had been labeled Caucasian Hispanic were suddenly now being labeled Indian, and they were no longer biracial, or they were just Indian. And we were not, and therefore we were unfit to raise these kids according to the system. And so we educated ourselves on the law. We looked into what the law says. We looked into what the intent was behind the law. And we realized very quickly that this is not what Congress intended in 1978. Congress intended this to be applied to kids who were being taken out of the Native American culture to begin with, that were involved in that culture, that were living on or near reservations, that were part of Indian communities, because it was all about maintaining culture. But these are kids who grew up 1,000 miles from their reservation, had no connection to their culture. Their mother, who's 1/8 Native, didn't even know the name of the tribe. And so we realized that this was not being applied as it was intended to be applied. However, the social workers saw it differently, and they continued to apply the act as anyway. And ultimately, through a series of miracles, we were able to prevail in that case. We were told it was very rare for a non-Indian family to be able to adopt Indian kids. But we saw... At first, we felt like, okay, we just want to walk away from the system because that was too difficult. What we had been through was just too painful. But we realized that God had brought us through that for a reason, and that was to help other people and to help other people navigate that system. And so we started reaching out and trying to reach others and educate them about what the Act says, educate them on some of the things that we were able to do in our case that gave us maybe an advantage and helped us to win the case. We had an incredible pair of attorneys that helped us in our case, and so we made it almost a crusade of ours to educate people and try to see change come about as it relates to the Indian Child Welfare Act. It's taken us to Congress. We talk to child welfare organizations all the time. We talk to social workers. We get calls from families all over the country that are dealing with ICWA cases. You know, we are talking to a family in South Carolina right now that has a little girl that's 1/128th Cherokee, and she was taken out of the adoptive home that she had been in since birth, and placed with a relative with her biological father, and the only reason she was placed with him was because she was part Cherokee. We don't believe that these children, their needs are any different from any other children. We don't believe that just because a child is 1% Cherokee or 6%, you know, Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, that suddenly their needs for attachment and their needs for stability and permanency are any different. We believe that their needs are the same and that the laws should protect them the same. And we don't believe that their placements should be disrupted just because they happen to have an ancestor 100 years ago that lived on a reservation. So like I said, we're just in the process of educating people and trying to effect change at this point. We've seen that, you know, as I've read the testimony and the studies that went into the passage of ICWA, that it was clear that the tribes were upset about the kids that were being taken off the reservation. It was clear that a lot of the research, that the psychological research and the studies, were faulty, and so Congress was not acting on the full picture. Even if they were, Congress was clearly not intending this to apply to kids that, like our kids, that were never part of the culture in the first place. One of the studies that came out was a study that by Dr. Joseph Westermeyer, and he testified before Congress. And Dr. Westermeyer had studied 17 psychiatric patients that were Native American and had been adopted and fostered in non-Native homes. Well, one of the problems is that Dr. Westermeyer was starting with psychiatric patients, so there will be issues. You know, I could find 17 psychiatric patients who drive Hondas, but that doesn't mean Honda causes psychiatric problems. He was talking to people that were 1/2 Native or more. He was talking to people that had been taken off the reservation. He was talking to a lot of people who had been placed as older children. And we all know that older children have experienced more trauma. It's much more difficult when they're placed in a new placement. He was talking to people who had been in multiple homes. So these people that he was talking to, these psychiatric patients, were a recipe for disaster already. You know, and you should expect problems regardless of race or ethnicity or culture. And so, but even then, in one of his studies, he concluded that the psychiatric patients he was interviewing were actually exhibiting a lot of the same behaviors that other Indian psychiatric patients were exhibiting that had not been fostered or adopted. Mm. He also concluded that the symptoms they were exhibiting and the behaviors were remarkably similar to non-Native adoptees and foster kids. And so, for Congress to take that information and say, well, clearly Indian kids in non-Indian homes is the problem, was a faulty conclusion based on faulty research.
Speak to why are the tribes being so aggressive? Like 1/16th, that sounds okay. Like when you hear 1/16th, okay, I can make sense of that. And then I hear, wait, that's great, great grandparent. And that's a long way off. That means somebody that the kid didn't even know is influencing this placement. And I know that you're not on the side of the tribes necessarily in this, but try to speak for why they're pursuing this.
That's an excellent question. And I will say that some tribes have been very cooperative in terms of wanting to look at what is in the best interest of a child. And there are tribes out there will say that if a child's been in a home for 2 years, let's leave the child in that home and maybe create some sort of cultural contract so that the adoptive parents can work with the tribe in helping the child maintain some sort of ties to the culture and understand the culture and things like that. There are other tribes that will come after a child that has very little connection. I know of a little girl in Oklahoma that a tribe came after that was 512, and the tribe came after her because her birth mom signed away her rights. The adoptive family was able to adopt the little girl, but the tribe in that case sent an email to the adoptive parents saying, "You're very lucky because we don't give up on our children easily." I wish I could tell you what the motivation for the tribes are. I can't tell you on an individual basis. I know that some tribes can receive more money, more federal money based on their members.
Yeah, and if I were to guess what some of their motivations would be, like, you know, the tribes are being slowly integrated away into mainstream American society, and that's a scary thing. And if you have tribal identity and love for your tribe and your culture, you don't want to see that slip away. So you're going to protect that. The question is the tribal identity more important than the well-being of the foster child? And that's what's in play. You know, you've got this people group and this cultural identity that is disappearing. Right. I think we can all recognize that. But does that override the well-being of a foster child who's 1/16th Native American, who's never been, who didn't even know that they were Native American?
See, that was one of the things that was fascinating to us about this case, is that when our boys came into the system, they had no knowledge that they were part Indian, and the tribe had never been involved in their lives. In fact, they were homeless for a while with their birth mother. They were living on the streets. They were living in somebody's backyard. They lived in an abandoned apartment in a bad area of town, and the tribe was nowhere. And they certainly weren't practicing, the tribal way of life by any means. It was only after they went into the foster care system that the tribe got involved. We were able to adopt, and we reached out to the tribe and said, you know, we would like to maintain contact. We would like for the kids to know about that side of their culture. And I personally researched their genealogy. I took them back 6 or 7 generations to Chief White Cloud, who was the chief of their tribe. And I did research, and I told the kids about this. We found a portrait of their ancestor hanging in the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. We took the boys to their reservation in Kansas. In spite of our efforts and in spite of their adoption social workers' efforts to reach out to the tribe has completely ignored them since the adoption. So I really wonder if for this particular tribe, if culture was really a part of it at all. Hmm. It certainly appears that it wasn't.
Yeah. And how this starts, if you're not aware, is every time a foster child's brought into care, the social workers have to ask, is this child part Native American, any part Native American? And usually the birth parents, they'll have some understanding that there are extra rights for Native American children. And if you don't know American culture very well, particularly in different parts of the country, everybody thinks that they have some Native American in them. It's kind of something, it's kind of like this myth that's passed on to you by your grandmother, and she doesn't really know what she's talking about, but oh yeah, you're part Native American. And I'm originally from Oklahoma, and that was just everywhere. Like, everybody assumed they had some Native American in them. So then the birth mother or birth father says, oh yeah, so-and-so's, you know, great-great uncle was, you know, Sioux or whatever. And they don't know, but they check the box. And then once that box is checked, it's very, you know, it's not a very thought-through act on the birth parent's part, but it becomes a very big deal for the foster child, because now everything has to be explored and every tribe has to be contacted.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because you mentioned that the social workers have to ask that question. That's not required by federal law.
Really?
The federal law requires that any time that you know or have reason to know that a child in a custody situation is an Indian child, then you have to trigger it. Triggers certain stipulations of the act, and you have to inquire, and you have to ask. I mean, you have to look into it, and if a relative says yes, they're part Cherokee, you need to investigate that at that point. But only if you know or have reason to know that the child is an Indian child. California has passed a law that says, okay, we want to address this on the front end when a kid just comes into foster care, because they don't want for a kid to come into foster care and be placed in a non-native home, stay in the home for a year and a half, and then all of a sudden somebody comes forward and says, by the way, the child is part Indian, because then everything changes and the kid has already formed attachments in that home. Mm-hmm. So I understand the reason behind the law. The problem is that it's not required by federal law that they ask. We have a family in our church that was recently fostering a little girl to adopt, and she had been adoptively placed, and she had been in the home for several months, and her birth mother had actually been killed tragically in a car accident. And just a couple of months before the adoption was to be finalized, the judge discovered that this piece of paper where that box was supposed to be checked could not be found in the file. So everything stopped for this little girl. This girl was on the fast track to adoption, and suddenly her adoption was delayed for 6 months while they tried to determine whether or not she was part Native. It turned out she wasn't. They were able to locate relatives and find out that she indeed was not part Native American. But here's the Indian Child Welfare Act delaying the adoption of a non-Indian child for 6 months. Certainly Congress didn't intend that. But at the same time, so I understand, again, why California passed that law. But the problem is, again, if you don't address it early on, then very often, right before parental rights are going to be terminated, a birth mother may be desperate to hang on to her parental rights, will claim heritage that may not be there. Social workers have told me, with kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge type of thing, that they are aware that birth parents do this, that birth relatives do this. They'll make false claims of Indian heritage just to slow down and just to stop the process of having their parental rights terminated. And like you say, everything stops. And all of a sudden, all these, I've heard of up to over 20 tribes. Yes, you know, I am part Indian, and it's either this. I've heard of a birth mother claim 22 or 23 tribes. And every one of those has to be investigated.
Right.
And so what they do is they say, okay, what was the name of your Indian ancestor? And they have to fill out this form and send it to all the tribes, send it to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they have to wait to hear from these tribes. So then what will happen is very often they'll come back and the tribes don't respond, or they do respond and say this kid is not, you know, that this is not an ICWA case. And so then they'll move forward, terminate parental rights, and then the birth mother, through her attorney, will file an appeal and say, well, you spelled my great-great-grandmother's name wrong. And then everything has to, then the appellate court will send it back and say, you got to do it again. And they got to notice all the tribes again. And adoptions can be delayed for months or years as they just chase this bunny trail. And it turns out very oftentimes these kids are not Indian in the first place. Hmm.
So what do you think can be done? How can people advocate? How are you advocating for the laws to be changed, for the intent to be followed?
Well, we are on a case-by-case basis, we're helping families across the country. And we'll get calls because World Magazine did a story on our family, and I wrote for Fostering Families Today magazine. And so we're sort of a lightning rod for these cases. And so we'll get calls from attorneys and from adoptive families saying, hey, you know, what do we do? How do we fight this? And we have a network of people who know the law. We have a network of people who, we have a couple of attorneys that we'll refer people to, so their attorneys can talk legalese with each other. And then we'll give the people tips as well on how to fight it. Some of those cases have been very successful, and the families have been able to adopt, and other cases they're not successful. But on a national level, we're trying to reach out to Congress. We're trying to reach out to Senate. And we've done, we did a teach-in in October of last year for congressional and senatorial aides, just trying to educate them about how ICWA was being applied, how it was intended to be applied, how it's affecting children, how it's being misapplied today. And we're going to have another one of those probably in June or July of this year, just trying to educate some of our policymakers about what this is all about. And we're trying to reach out also to some of the child welfare organizations as well. The problem is that a lot of those have bought into what the tribal lobby is telling them, and they're still saying we're losing all our kids. Indian kids are overrepresented in foster care. That's another misleading stat. You often hear that Indian kids are 1% of the population in the United States, but they represent 2% of the kids in foster care. Well, if you think about it, like our children were not labeled Indian in the general population, so they wouldn't have been, like I say, they weren't considered Indian until they went into foster care. So a lot of these kids don't get labeled Indian until they're placed in foster care and their birth parents bring this issue up. And so, of course, you're going to have what appears to be an overrepresentation just because they're being relabeled once they get into foster care.
Yeah, based on those numbers, 4% of the population should be labeled as Native American. Of the general population should be labeled as Native American, perhaps. You know, if you're going to go to the great-great-grandparent, so that means only 2% of foster kids, so actually they're better than most demographics.
Again, you got to recognize, too, that every tribe determines its own membership laws. I mean, there are some tribes that they're the Ute tribe in Utah. They require 5/8 blood quantum, 5/8 blood quantum in order to be eligible for membership. So a child that's, if you want to, you know, look at it this way, if a child that is half Ute and goes into the foster care system, the ICWA does not apply to that child. That child could have been raised on the reservation. They could have one biological, full-blooded biological Ute parent, live on the reservation all their lives, and then go into the foster care system, but the act doesn't apply to them. Huh. And then you could have this little girl who's 1/512 Cherokee. Yeah, I don't even know how many greats that is, about 7 or 8 great-grandparents, you know, and hasn't, you know, their last Indian ancestor lived in 1810 or wow. something, and could have grown up 1,000 miles, 2,000 miles from the reservation, uh-huh. or no, from Indian country. The Cherokee don't have a reservation, but ICWA applies to that child. So this child is considered an Indian child, where the child who grew up on the reservations, who's half Ute, is not Indian.
Wow.
Some tribes are not federally recognized. We have a daughter who's Lumbee Indian. She's 1/4 Lumbee Indian, which makes her 4 times as Indian as our 2 sons. ICWA didn't apply to her, even though she's 4 times as Native as the boys, because the Lumbee tribe is not federally recognized. So it's inconsistently applied. It's misapplied. And again, there's a judicially created exception to the ICWA placement preferences called the existing Indian family doctrine. And some states recognize it. A lot of states don't recognize it. And some states are silent on it. And basically what that says is, if a child has no previous political, social, or cultural ties to the tribe, then it's unconstitutional to apply the Indian Child Welfare Act placement preferences to that child. If you read the original transcripts, if you read the studies and everything that went into, and the testimony that went into the passage of ICWA, that makes perfect sense. Now, the tribes would argue it doesn't make sense. The tribes would say, no, it's any Indian kid. It's any kid that we decide is an Indian kid.
We were offered a set of siblings at one point that were part Native American, and we very intentionally chose not to take that placement because we were worried about the long-term stability of that placement. And what would you say to people who are presented with Native American children or who already have Native American children in their house, whether it's half or 1/16th?
Well, you bring that up, and I'm glad you did, because I know of an attorney who has told me that his boss is actually recommended to people that they not take Native American kids.
And that, let me just say, that is a tragedy. Like, that means the law is hurting children.
It is.
Because those kids deserve to be placed, whoever they are.
I absolutely agree. That's the thing. It's, you know, we need to see, that, as the church, we need to see that if we have a child placed in our home and this child happens to be Native American, and the Indian Child Welfare Act is applied, if we believe that it's not in the best interest of that child to be moved to another home, we have an obligation to God to speak up on behalf of that child. Proverbs 31:8 says that we're to speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. That child in foster care does not have a voice. And it's not just for us to just stand by and let the system do what it's going to do. Yes, we do need to follow the law. I understand that. But we also need to look at the intent of the law. We need to look at whatever loopholes we can find in the law. If we believe it's in the best interest of that child to stay with us or to stay with another family, then we need to fight for that. Just the same way, if we believe it's in the best interest of that child to be reunified with a birth parent, we need to fight for that as well. We need to look at whatever is best for that child in our home. We need to fight for that, and we need to speak up for that, even if we're going to have to go head-to-head with the system.
So how can people move forward if they want to join your network or contact you? Probably the best thing for them to do is just to contact us at info@fosterpodcast.com, and we can forward their info on to you. Are there any other things that you would recommend people do or advocate for?
Well, I would encourage people, again, to educate themselves that they're running into a situation where they're facing an issue with a law or a policy. It doesn't have to be ICWA. And they don't understand it. They don't believe it's in the best interest. Educate themselves. Find out what policy says. Find out what the intent of the law is. And again, be willing to speak up and seek justice for that child. If you're running into problems with the Indian Child Welfare Act, I would be happy to talk to you. I'd be happy to contact you with attorneys and others who know the law and can help you fight the law or fight for what's in the best interest of that kid. If this sort of thing makes you angry, write letters. Write letters to your congresspeople, you know, to your senators, and just tell them that you want to see the law changed. You know, there are some of us who would like to see the law thrown out altogether. Some of us who would be happy to just see it amended. I really would love to see the law thrown out and we start over. But we have to look at what's in the best interest of children. We have to quit looking at what's in the best interest of special interest groups or people groups or whatever. We need to look at what's in the best interest of children.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for coming. I love your passion for it. I love you just educating me, you know, on the fly about it. And I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it too. Thanks.
Thanks.
Welcome back. Welcome back, Wend. Everybody else was here with me. Goodbye, Johnston. Welcome back, Wendy.
Well, good job, honey.
Thanks.
I always like it when you do an episode for me and all I have to do is say hello and goodbye and listen to an interview. But good job. Good job to both of you.
And I'm sure there'll be comments.
I'm certain that there will be. And I'm eager to hear them because it's a controversial thing, but I think Johnston makes his case and he's got the actual experience as an adoptive dad to go with it.
Yeah. And if you want to contact Johnston, we have his website, which is www.home-4-ever.org. And that will be on our show notes for this episode as well. So visit fosterpodcast.com and you can get connected with Johnston virtually.
Virtually.
Electronically.
Through electronic mail.
That's it for today. To leave a comment or ask a question, please visit our website, fosterpodcast.com.
Or send us an email, info@fosterpodcast.com.
Names have been changed on this show to protect the privacy of those involved.
Foster parenting is the most frustrating, heart-wrenching, all-consuming thing we've ever done.
But when it comes down to it, it's just about helping kids. And that's been the most rewarding thing in our lives.
If you've ever thought you might adopt or foster, we challenge you to take the next step today.